The Hawking effect caused nausea, vertigo, headache, and hallucinations. The first leg of the voyage was the 10-day transit to Parvati on the Hegemony torch ship HS Intrepid. Sol held Rachel and endured. They were the only people fully conscious aboard the warship. At first, Rachel cried, but after some hours she lay quietly in Sol's arms and stared up at him with large dark eyes. Sol remembered the day she was born. The medics had taken the infant from atop Saray's warm stomach and handed her to Sol. Rachel's dark hair was not much shorter then, her gaze no less profound. Eventually they slept from sheer exhaustion. Sol dreamed that he was wandering through a structure with columns the size of redwood trees and a ceiling lost to sight far above him. Red light bathed cool emptiness. Sol was surprised to find that he still carried Rachel in his arms. Rachel, as a child, had never been in his dream before. The infant looked up at him, and Sol felt the contact of her consciousness as surely as if she had spoken aloud. Suddenly, a different voice, immense and cold, echoed through the void. "Sol, take your daughter, your only daughter Rachel, whom you love, and go to the world called Hyperion, and offer her there as a burnt offering at one of the places of which I shall tell you." Sol hesitated and looked back to Rachel. The baby's eyes were deep and luminous as she looked up at her father. Sol felt the unspoken yes. Holding her tightly, he stepped forward into the darkness and raised his voice against the silence. "Listen, there will be no more offerings, neither child nor parent. There will be no more sacrifices for anyone other than our fellow human. The time of obedience and atonement is past." Sol listened. He could feel the pounding of his heart and Rachel's warmth against his arm. From somewhere high above, there came the cold sound of wind through unseen fissures. Sol cupped his hand to his mouth and shouted, "That's all! Now either leave us alone, or join us as a father rather than a receiver of sacrifices. You have the choice of Abraham." Rachel stirred in his arms as a rumble grew out of the stone floor. Columns vibrated. The red gloom deepened and then winked out, leaving only darkness. From far away there came the boom of huge footsteps. Sol hugged Rachel to him as a violent wind roared past. There was a glimmer of light as both he and Rachel awoke on the HS Intrepid, outward bound for Parvati, to transfer to the tree ship Yggdrasil for the planet Hyperion. Sol smiled at his 7-week-old daughter. She smiled back. It was her last, or her first, smile.
The main cabin of the wind wagon was silent when the old scholar finished his story. Sol cleared his throat and took a drink of water from a crystal goblet. Rachel slept on in the makeshift cradle of the open drawer. The wind wagon rocked gently on its way, the rumble of the great wheel and the hum of the main gyroscope a lulling background noise.
"My God,"
Braun Lamia said softly. She started to speak again and then merely shook her head. Martin Silenus closed his eyes and said,
"Considering that, all hatred driven hence, the soul recovers radical innocence and learns at last that it is self-delighting, self-appeasing, self-affrighting, and that its own sweet will is heaven's will. She can, though every face will scowl and every windy quarter howl or every bellows burst, be happy still."
Sol Weintraub asked,
"William Butler Yeats?"
Silenus nodded.
A prayer for my daughter.
I think I'm going up on deck for a breath of air before turning in,
said the consul.
Would anyone care to join me?
Everyone did. The breeze of their passage was refreshing as the group stood on the quarterdeck and watched the darkened sea of grass rumble by. The sky was a great, star-splashed bowl above them, scarred by meteor trails. The sails and rigging creaked with a sound as old as human travel.
I think we should post guards tonight,
said Colonel Cassad.
One person on watch while the others sleep. 2-hour intervals.
I agree. I'll take the first watch.
In the morning,
began Cassad. Look, cried Father Hoyt. They followed his pointing arm. Between the blaze of constellations, colored fireballs flared. Green, violet, orange, green again, illuminating the great plain of grass around them like flashes of heat lightning. The stars and meteor trails paled to insignificance beside the sudden display. Explosions? Ventured the priest.
Space battle,
said Cassad.
Cislunar, fusion weapons.
He went below quickly.
The tree,
said Het Mastin, pointing to a speck of light which moved among the explosions like an ember floating through a fireworks display. Cassad returned with his powered binoculars and handed them around.
Ousters? Is it the invasion?
Ousters, almost certainly. But almost as certainly, just a scouting raid. See the clusters? Those are hegemony missiles being exploded by the ouster ram scout's countermeasures.
The binoculars came to the consul. The flashes were quite clear now, an expanding cumulus of flame. He could see the speck and long blue tail of at least 2 scout ships fleeing from the hegemony pursuers.
I don't think,
began Cassad, and then stopped as the ship and sails and sea of grass glowed bright orange in reflected glare.
Dear Christ, whispered Father Hoyt. They've hit the tree ship.
The consul swept the glasses left. The growing nimbus of flames could be seen with the naked eye. But in the binoculars, the kilometer-long trunk and branch array of the Yggdrasil was visible for an instant as it burned and flared, long tendrils of flame arcing away into space as the containment fields failed and the oxygen burned. The orange cloud pulsed, faded, and fell back on itself as the trunk became visible for a final second, even as it glowed and broke up, like the last long ember in a dying fire. Nothing could have survived. The tree ship Yggdrasil, with its crew and complement of clones and semi-sentient Urg drivers, was dead. The consul turned toward Het Mastin and belatedly held out the binoculars.
I'm so sorry.
The tall Templar did not take the glasses. Slowly he lowered his gaze from the skies, pulled forward his cowl, and went below without a word. The death of the tree ship was the final explosion. When 10 minutes had passed and no more flares had disturbed the night, Braun Lamia spoke.
Do you think they got them?
The ousters?
Said Cassad.
Probably not. The scout ships are built for speed and defense. They're light minutes away by now.
Did they go after the tree ship on purpose?
Asked Silenus. The poet sounded very sober.
I think not. Merely a target of opportunity.
Target of opportunity,
echoed Saul Weintraub. The scholar shook his head.
I'm going to get a few hours sleep before sunrise.
One by one the others went below. When only Cassad and the consul were left on deck, the consul said,
Where should I stand watch?
Make a circuit. From the main corridor at the base of the ladder, you can see all of the stateroom doors and the entrance to the mess and galley. Come above and check the gangway and decks. Keep the lanterns lit. Do you have a weapon?
The consul shook his head. Cassad handed over his death wand.
It's on tight beam, about half a meter at 10 meters range. Don't use it unless you're sure that there's an intruder. The rough plate that slides forward is the safety. It's on.
The consul nodded, making sure that his finger stayed away from the firing stud.
I'll relieve you in 2 hours,
said Kassad. He checked his comm log.
It'll be sunrise before my watch is over.
Kassad looked at the sky as if expecting the Yggdrasil to reappear and continue its firefly path across the sky. Only the stars glowed back. On the northeastern horizon, a moving mass of black promised a storm. Kassad shook his head.
A waste,
he said, and went below. The consul stood there a while and listened to the wind in the canvas, the creak of rigging, and the rumble of the wheel. After a while, he went to the railing and stared at darkness while he thought.